It is a state capitol report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We dive into the fiscal position of our state and a Republican package of tax cuts, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Republican State Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam is co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Representative Bourne, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Good to be with you.
Good morning. So starting with the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, now estimating our state's operating budget, our general fund will reach about a $3.2 billion surplus at the end of the two-year budget cycle. What is your reaction to those new estimates that are down from a previous $4.3 billion surplus?
Still a very strong financial position for the state. The estimates were adjusted less than 1%, so still seeing good growth, still have a large surplus, as you mentioned, $3.2 billion. That doesn't even include our rainy day fund, which is a little over $1.8 billion now. So continuing to be in a really good fiscal shape. And after a strong budget where we invested in a lot of priorities, it's time to return some of that surplus to the taxpayers.
Governor Tony Evers delivered his State of the State address, as you know, last week, and the governor said Wisconsin is starting the year in the best fiscal position in state history.
As we enter 2024, our state has never been in a better fiscal position than we are today, better than last year, better than when I took office, and better than any year in Wisconsin, 176 years of statehood.
Do you agree with that assessment, the governor's optimism about our state government's financial position?
Yeah, I guess it kind of echoes what I just said, too. I mean, we're on the same page on that. We're in great fiscal shape as a state. We're maintaining a strong surplus. And really, it's, you know, more than a decade now of sound fiscal management, Republican legislative budgets with large tax cuts, investments in key areas, have been support for the economy, and then it's the great small businesses and workforce we have here in Wisconsin growing this economy, and the state continues to be in strong financial shape even through a pandemic and through some uncertain times here in the last couple of years with really high inflation that has been tough on families and businesses. The state has come through pretty strong, and the indicators we saw in this last memo from the Fiscal Bureau, you know, it looks like we're in a strong spot to continue.
What do you think is like a comfortable and sensible general fund surplus cushion? Like what is your type of benchmark?
I think that with the tax cut that we're proposing is about $2 billion, which will leave a little over $1 billion in the general fund, coupled with our rainy day fund that I mentioned at 1.8, you know, we're going to be sitting on about $3 billion in cash. And that's a pretty sound amount of money to be sitting on for our general fund and for how much we spend in our annual and, well, our biannual budget as it's written, but looking annually at our GPR spend, that's a pretty solid cash flow.
So, as you mentioned, the four bills that Republican leaders have announced would cost the state about $2 billion in tax revenue, and you're comfortable with that tax relief and what the and depleting the general fund surplus, you know, to that extent.
Yeah, I think that's a good amount. As I mentioned in our budget, we spent a lot of money on a lot of important areas, infrastructure, education, healthcare. We had a big tax cut in there. The governor vetoed most of it. We've sent two tax cuts to him since then. This will be the third attempt. We keep modifying it, hoping we can find the right package that the governor will support, because we think coupled with that spending, it's important to have tax relief. We had a large, more than $7 billion surplus. We're going to keep some of it in the fund, as we've already mentioned. And this is a good amount for a tax cut, and it focuses on the middle class and important areas. And that's something that the governor said was a priority. If you go back a year ago to a state of state address, he said middle class tax cuts was a priority for him. He kind of set that number, income number, at about $150,000. So that's what we're focused on and what we're coming back with for a middle class tax cut. broadening the second income bracket to $150,000 for a major drug filer from $38,000. Also looking at providing tax relief for retirees. Also, something else that the governor has said is important to him is the child care, the rising cost of child care, and helping families with that. So our tax cut includes expanding the child independent care tax credit. So there's a lot of opportunity here in areas that the governor's already identified. That middle class tax cut that we're proposing would be an average tax cut of $454 per filer. That expanded child independent care tax credit would be an average tax cut of $656 to help those families paying for child care. So there's a lot of opportunity here and stuff that he's identified and we've identified looking for that compromise, like we found grand compromise, you know, earlier in this session for the
shared revenue,
the brewers here.
For brewers,
and for helping,
sure.
And for helping local government. Both of those are great ones, great examples.
Well, let me just reintroduce you here, Representative Mark Bourne, leader of the legislature's Budget Writing Committee, as we look at the financial position of our state and proposed tax relief, tax cut package. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Mary Kay in Kenosha is here. Mary Kay, hi.
Hi. This has to be something done with the IRS. The reality is there are many homeless families either living with other people or they're not living anywhere at all. And they are working and they are paying taxes, but their income doesn't allow them enough to be able to drive a car, put insurance on the car, have insurance for their family, get an apartment with escrows because they have skyrocketed. The real estate companies have skyrocketed everything. So we need a tax credit for the homeless working people. Okay, but we need to tie it into the IRS for future years. They don't, you know, what I'm saying is only those people really need the help right now. They are working, and they are working practically for nothing.
Mary Kay, thank you. Representative Bourne, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, the good news in Wisconsin is for anyone earning below, and I don't have the number in front of me, but I think it's $27,000 on that first bracket. They're paying no income taxes already in Wisconsin. So, I mean, she mentioned the IRS, so maybe her concerns are more with the federal tax system. But we already have a bracketed system with lower rates and in fact, no rates once you're below that certain level. So that's certainly a good tax system for folks that are trying to work their way out of a situation or working poor, I think is what sometimes folks refer to. So, I think we're already in a pretty good spot on that here in Wisconsin. And we know that, you know, middle-class families in these inflationary times are struggling just as much. And that's why, you know, the tax has to be focused on the folks that are paying and focused on that middle class and those lower two brackets.
So which of the four tax cut bills is most important to you?
I think that, boy, that's like asking you to pick your favorite child or something here, but they're certainly all important. I would say if I had to pick one, I would say the retirement income exclusion, because we see a lot of folks making the decision to move to states that don't tax those retirement benefits. We're losing a lot of our seniors and institutional memory and experience here in Wisconsin, and so I think if we can help those folks on fixed incomes with that relief, that's something else that the caller didn't identify, but it goes along the same strain. If you're, you know, struggling to stay in your home as property taxes are rising on fixed income, these can have a huge benefit to retirees. And the average tax cut for seniors would be over $1,500 per filer by excluding retirement income for everyone age 65 up to $150,000 for joint filers. So again, targeting that magic number that the governor talked about a year ago as his middle class. So very focused on the middle class, and in this case, focused on retirees.
Really quick before we move on, would Republicans have enough support from Democrats, do you think, to override a veto by the governor here?
I guess we'll see as the bills move through the process, but this retirement income exclusion, for example, is a bill that's been out there for a while. It does have Dem co-sponsors on the bill, so I'm certainly expecting some bipartisan support on that one, and I would think the child dependent tax care credit for sure. So hoping for a broad bipartisan support because, you know, these are good ideas, and we've been willing to modify our position on tax cuts. This is the fourth tax cut in 6 or 8 months now. And while the governor and the state of the state really stuck to, you know, a lot of the old tired things, we're always willing to adjust and try to find common ground and those compromises like we did, as we mentioned, on local governments and the brewers earlier this year.
Republican Representative Mark Bourne is co-chair of the legislature's Budget Writing Committee. You can join in at any point as we discuss legislative proposals and fiscal policy. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As lawmakers prepare for another floor period in about 2 weeks, we check in with Republican State Representative Mark Bourne of Beaver Dam. Bourne co-chairs the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So the state assembly advanced a measure that could allow Wisconsin voters to ban abortions after 14 weeks of pregnancy, and current law bans abortions after 20 weeks. Why do you support this referendum approach?
I think it's just important on an issue that has been so divisive and so emotional, really across the spectrum, from folks that believe, you know, no abortion should ever exist, to folks that believe it should be, you know, right up until birth and everywhere in between. And it's important to have Wisconsin, you know, have a law that's, you know, more in sync with the rest of the world. You know, you look at European countries and they have an abortion ban that's usually in that 12 to 14 week area. That seems to be kind of the standard, that first trimester. And so why not offer that up to the voters, let the voters decide, let them have the final say, because it's been such a difficult issue on really on both sides. And one of the more, you know, challenging ones, certainly of our political time. And I just think it's the right approach to let the voters weigh in.
What is your position on banning abortions after 14 weeks?
I've always been pro-life. You know, I would prefer that abortions didn't happen, but I realize they do. And I realize, like I said, that this is really important to a lot of folks to have access to that. So that's why I think it's better to put it to the voters and not just have it be, you know, what each individual preference is, but try to set a standard that is reasonable, that is, like I said, followed by a lot of other countries and both in states in this country as well as a lot of other countries around the world. And so let's try to set a reasonable standard and see if the voters think that's a reasonable standard by asking them for them to weigh in on this important issue.
The bill passed the assembly 53-46. There were nearly a dozen of your Republican colleagues who voted no on this. Does your caucus have different visions for what abortion access should look like in Wisconsin?
Well, sure it does. I mean, just like it does across the state, you know, from individual to individual, as I said, this is a very difficult issue, a very divisive and emotional issue for a lot of people. And so certainly as representative of the state, our caucus is in the different. There's a wide range. I would assume in the Dem Assembly caucus, there's a wide range, too, on what are the right laws to have in place. And that reflects the state. So that's why it's good to take this one to the voters and let the state voters decide if this is the right statute, the right law to have on Wisconsin's books.
Let's go to Mike in Lake Mills now. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a couple comments about abortion. It was 1968 when I started working the abortion issue in upstate New York with Senator Sam Stratton. It is not a government issue. It is a family issue. The family values that Republicans say they have but don't. It is between a wife, a husband, and their family. I remember in the 60s when women had to travel out of state to get abortions to save their life. What Christians did then we gathered and we prayed. We prayed for insight. We prayed for forgiveness. When your religion crosses my threshold to tell me how to live.
Okay, Mike, I'm going to jump in here. Representative Bourne, there are a lot of emotions on this issue. And I'm just one. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, and I think that, you know, when the caller said that this is not something that government should be involved in, I think that, you know, when you asked about the variety of opinions just in my caucus, I think there would be members that agree with that. And that's part of why we brought this proposal forward, to try to get it out of our caucus, our legislature, get it before the people, see if this standard, which is accepted in a lot of developed countries around the world, is the right standard for Wisconsin, and let the voters weigh in.
Talking with State Representative Mark Bourne, looking at policies, proposals here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question, share insights, 800-642-1234. Turning now to election maps, in December, the state Supreme Court rules that our state's election maps for legislative districts were unconstitutional. New maps must be drawn. And the legislature has approved new maps, but the governor has then vowed to veto them. Why do you support the new maps?
I just think that another one of these places where we should try to find compromise. We should stop spending all this money on attorneys, stop all these lawsuits. It's just a waste of time and resources, and it's time to move on. And we can all agree to disagree, I guess. I mean, certainly we felt that the maps we have were appropriate. The court decided otherwise, so it's time to move on. And we're trying to compromise by, picking the map that the governor had proposed with some very minor changes. We tried to also compromise a few months ago by proposing to move forward with the Iowa model of redistricting. You know, I just think especially Assembly Republicans are very interested in moving forward with compromise. The Senate Republicans have joined us in this latest effort. And, I think it would be great if the governor would meet us partway on this.
Do you think are Republicans likely to approve different maps to avoid the Supreme Court drawing its own maps?
I don't think it's about avoiding anything. I mean, the Constitution is clear. The court's own ruling was clear that the role of drawing the map is the legislature's role. The court, in their own ruling in December, encouraged the legislature to do so. It just, because there is a very, very, very tight timeline to get this done before we need to start circulating papers for the next election, the court has said they will take action if the legislature and then the governor can't complete a bill to do that by then. So certainly the legislature should continue efforts to draw the maps, and hopefully the governor will work with us on that.
I mean, what does a politically neutral map mean to you and fellow Republicans? I mean, what is your interpretation of that?
I think that it's hard to tell in this day and age what a politically neutral map is and if it even exists, because almost anything you do in this very hyper-partisan world that we live in now will have some lens of partisanship. But I think that, that's why we looked at the governor's map and said, well, this isn't, we think, the most fair map. It certainly had some very targeted drawings on some individual legislators, some individual incumbents. But, if the governor thought this was a map he could live with, we could live with it too.
Running against fellow incumbents?
Well, there was a lot of pairing of incumbents. But then also there were some, you look at up in the, I think it's the 75th, Pat Snyder up in the Wausau area where he was taken out of his district just by a few blocks. There were a few other legislators that were kind of like that. It seems unusual that any data-driven thing would draw a map by just across the street in the case of one legislator in the Fox Valley, or just drawing one ward out of the city of Wausau and just capturing that incumbent by a few. I think there were some targeted things, but that's part of why this is such a partisan thing. It just depends on what side is doing it. They're always looking for advantage in our political system nowadays, and it makes it hard to do that. So that's why we're trying to compromise with the governor.
And only about 20 seconds left here. What does the Joint Finance Committee plan to address in the weeks ahead? A little bit of a preview.
We'll have a lot of legislation moving through the process. We've got the legislation with the EW system that was a compromise, and a few other small spending bills. But we're wrapping up the session here in the next month or so.
Representative Bourne, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Bourne is a Republican state representative from Beaver Dam. He is co-chair of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Egg Day at the Capitol is set for Wednesday when farmers and the agricultural industry assert priorities and discuss policy proposals with lawmakers. We get a preview, and you can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jason Mugnaini is Executive Director of Governmental Relations for the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. Jason, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. And a quick good morning to my daughter, Amelia, who I missed on my way to the office this morning. So I know she's listening. But thank you so much for having me and getting an opportunity to talk about Ag Day and some of agriculture's priorities here before the legislative session wraps up.
Well, let's dig in here. There's legislation aiming to allow health coverage benefits for farmers. How would Farm Bureau health plans better suit the needs of farmers and their families?
Sure. So this is a piece of legislation that, you know, we unfortunately had to bring out of a necessity where there's a plan that's operating in seven other states right now through their farm bureaus, because there's a circumstance under the way that the Affordable Care Act and the way that our farm businesses are set up that's kind of leaving farmers out of the equation. So this is a healthcare product that is a rated health plan, and it's not going to be a solution for everybody. But because farmers are in kind of a unique spot within their income because of the way that income is calculated, and then there's commodity volatility every single year, farmers are in this circumstance where in one year they might get a subsidy under the Affordable Care Act to be able to help pay for some of those premiums and make that affordable. But in the following year, you might have a really good year with your commodity prices, and then all of a sudden you're left out of the subsidy. So you have a moving target year after year with, farm income that really hasn't met the needs of farmers. And because of that, you've got a lot of the smaller producers choosing to go uninsured, or what's really happening is a lot of families are saying, all right, it's you or it's me, and someone's got to go off the farm and go into town to get a job. And then, you know, they're not really making anything on that job. They're using that income to then turn around and pay for labor on the farm to come in. And that person's ultimately not going to be, provided benefits either. So we have a circumstance where this is, there needs to be something else in the marketplace that could potentially help farmers. And we think like an organization like Farm Bureau could provide a tangible existing product as an option.
There are some organizations who oppose the bill, like the Wisconsin Office of the Commissioner of Insurance and the Wisconsin Farmers Union. They worry removing young and healthy people from the insurance pool would inflate insurance premiums for people who do use the Affordable Care Act marketplace. What is your response to that view?
Sure. And like I said, this is already existing in seven other states. Tennessee has been operating a plan since 1947. Kansas is probably our most recent plan, and they've really done a great job of onboarding their plan within theirs. And the reality of those kinds of concerns of impacts to the ACA marketplace just haven't really been borne out in other states. Iowa, our neighbor right here to the to the West, they actually took on a plan and they saw a 50% growth in their ACA marketplace, while they saw decreases in the total cost of their average benchmark plan. So we don't see those types of things bearing out in the same way. Where I think you're really going to see of more of an impact of a Wisconsin or of a Farm Bureau health plan in Wisconsin is really going to be people saying, all right, now I have an option that I can come back to the farm full time. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see people leaving employer-based care rather than somebody leaving the ACA. And the real hope that we get here out of all of this is that we get people who are uninsured, those people who are in rural areas who are saying, you know, I just don't need it. It's an expense that I don't need to incur. I'm a healthy person. Well, sure, you're healthy until you're not. And in an industry like farming, you know, which is oftentimes somewhat dangerous or can be potentially dangerous, we want to make sure that those individuals are really the ones who are getting coverage. And if this is an affordable option that people think works for them, fantastic.
The legislation would allow health insurance providers to use a patient's health history to determine whether to provide coverage and how much coverage, and this strategy is intended to lower enrollees' costs. Could this type of provision allow enough room for discrimination at the sake of cost savings?
So we don't have to beat around the bush. What this really is we have to make sure that there's a way to provide cost savings. And the reality of this is when you have a comprehensive health product like Farm Bureau health plans, we cover everything from, you know, maternity services, preventative care, pre-cancer screenings, all of those types of things. There has to be a way in which you can come up with some sort of cost savings. And we do look at patients' prior health history, and in some rare circumstances, under 10% in all seven states that offer this plan, there have been some circumstances where they've denied coverage. The result of all of this, though, is that we're able to provide a product that's between 30 and 60% less expensive than an unsubsidized ACA plan. The reality of it is that the ACA is, you know, subsidized to 80-something percent, and, you know, we're never going to be able to compete with that. So you still have the vast majority of people who are going to be participating in that, staying in that pool. Where we actually see the impact of Farm Bureau health plans is reducing the amount of uninsured care that we're seeing in rural hospitals, and we actually were fortunate enough to have some representatives from Kansas Farm Bureau come to Wisconsin and testify before the Senate committee a week or so ago. And that was one of the things that they shared, is they're really seeing a reduction in rural uninsured care in Kansas. And we'd like to see that type of result here in Wisconsin as well.
Jason Muniaini is Executive Director of Governmental Relations at the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. As we talk about policy and Ag Day at the Capitol this Wednesday, you can join in with questions and comments. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Jason, the Farm Bureau Federation worries about farmers losing their autonomy, and your group wants to limit more regulations on animal welfare and how animals are used. How could fewer restrictions keep Wisconsin farms at a competitive advantage?
Well, the number one name in the game is making sure that Wisconsin farmers have consistency, and that's both nationwide and on a statewide basis. There was a law that was passed via ballot initiative in the state of California in 2018 called Prop 12 that, if you're in agriculture, you're aware of it. But if you're not, what this has done is this has kind of created some animal welfare standards that were developed within California. But because California is a net importer of pork and veal and egg products, those standards were kind of placed on farmers in other states that would provide products to the California market. So there was a big lawsuit that resulted in the U.S. Supreme Court upholding California's right to impose those standards. But now we're seeing other states and local municipalities around the country try to impose some of these, you know, restrictions on agriculture, the result of which is going to create kind of a fractured commodity marketplace. And what we're concerned about here, and the reason that Assembly Bill 957, Senate Bill 952, what we're calling the Protect Our Farms Act, is before the legislature, is I think we have an opportunity to say, All right, let's make sure that if we're going to have a conversation about animal agriculture and the types of protocols that we want to see in Wisconsin, let's have that at the state level rather than having a fractured county by county or municipality by municipality circumstance that can really hyper impact, a single individual farm. And I want to be clear about this legislation. None of this legislation is going to impact with the environmental requirements of what a farm is going to have to do. All of those things, nutrient management plans, CAFO permitting, all of those things will still be in place. This is really going to be related to animal welfare types of protocols. But one of the things that's unique that people aren't aware of is in animal agriculture, in livestock agriculture, 99.9% of milk that comes from, any dairy in the United States has to go through an animal welfare program or be purchased through something called the Farm Program, which establishes animal welfare protocols. For pork, it's called the WeCare program, and they're into the 85 and 90 percentiles for the amount of pork that they're producing going through those types of animal welfare programs. So you're already seeing the industry kind of do some of these animal welfare practices, but when you have kind of these very emotionally driven protocol ordinances, you can really result in some fractured circumstances where the regulatory requirements can differ municipality by municipality, and that increases challenges with transportation, with pricing, with cutting into margins and cutting into inputs, which can really have a detrimental effect on a operation like agriculture that's oftentimes kind of operating at the margins.
Well, let's just look for just a moment at CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. Wisconsin Watch has reported that opponents of the bill to limit further regulations on farms, like the Humane Society of the United States and Animal Wellness Action, and opponents say that the bill would limit local authority over farms and unravel safeguards against these large CAFOs. What is your response to that?
So there hasn't been any circumstances where we've seen on an animal protocol ordinance here in the state of Wisconsin related to animal agriculture. So this is really a preemptive thing to say, if we're going to have these conversations, let's have them at the state level. What we're also concerned about is that some of our existing dairy farms, to be able to stay profitable and in just in existence, last year we had over 400 dairies close, may have to grow a little bit. And as an attempt to potentially stop that growth, we've already seen circumstances where people will organize to try to potentially stop the growth of a farm and force them out of business by enacting just frivolous ordinances to impact them. I think that kind of falls into that as well. Those local controls in terms of zoning requirements, livestock siting, those are all still maintained within the current array of a local municipality's ability to, modify the things that are happening within their community. These are really specifically related to preventing things that would proliferate, that would kind of prevent an operation from doing the protocols necessary to meet the needs of their farms. And I've heard concerns that this is going to allow, worse outcomes for animal welfare. And I would actually attest that the opposite is the case, is that, a farmer's livestock, that's their well-being, that's their welfare, that's the product that they're selling. I'm hard pressed to think that Wisconsin agriculturalists and farmers would try to inhibit their own bottom line by not having high quality standards for their animals. And in Wisconsin, when you sell milk, that milk is sold by the components. It's sold by how good is your butter fat? What are your protein levels? How good is the quality of your milk? And those things come from healthy cows. So we want to make sure that we're providing a farmer's autonomy in consultation with their veterinarians to make appropriate things and not have that really be dictated by local government with maybe an ulterior agenda.
Jason Muniaini with us leads government and policy initiatives at the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation and ahead of Ag Day at the state capitol. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of farmers and people who work in the agriculture industry, they're expected to turn out for Ag Day at the Capitol Wednesday. And we discuss legislation and policy priorities with the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation's Executive Director of Governmental Relations. And that is Jason Muniaini. Call in with the question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield with a question. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. My concern, comment, question has to do with groundwater protections in Wisconsin. And I realize how difficult farming can be and tight margins and whatever else, but we have a groundwater problem in Wisconsin, as evidenced by wells contaminated with nitrates in the central part of the state, Lake Winnebago with toxic algae blooms, trout streams being degraded. So what is the Farm Bureau's position on supporting legislature that will protect groundwater? Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Jason, go ahead.
Jeff, really appreciate that question. I'm glad you brought this one up because I think it's a place where there's a lot of evolving things in this space that I think can really be beneficial. One of the first pieces is we've long been supporters of a piece of legislation that has been kind of stifled in the legislature for a while, but we want to provide some additional funding to kind of the well compensation program, specifically for those people who are impacted by nitrates. And I think that there's a you know, support for this, and we've seen this kind of piece of legislation in the legislature, and we're hopeful that we might be able to get it over the hump here at the end of the session. But that's certainly a concern. And I actually think that one of the real ways that we're going to be able to improve this is actually going to be through the use of technology. I think that there's a lot of opportunities in the future for not only just for agriculture, but for other industries like wastewater that, you know, provide biosolids that have some levels of contaminants that'll be able to filter that out and provide a more filtered product to those who are land spreading those types of things. I was just recently in Utah at the American Farm Bureau annual meeting, and I was talking to some representatives from John Deere that were showcasing one of their really cool new products that I think is cool is a product that when it's a planter, and then when the seed hits the ground, they've timed it so that a very tiny little spritz of fertilizer hits that seed right as it hits the ground, and that's able to reduce fertilizer costs for farmers, but additionally, fertilizer in general, by 60%. But I think that there's something that we need to have as a larger conversation with just farm consolidation, the, you know, tight margins that farming has right now, to be able to try to connect the gap of the technology gap between large and small producers. And that's something that we're going to be working on, hopefully, here in the next year, to be able to really connect that gap with technology for small producers. And I think that that's really going to have an impact. Additionally, we have great programs in Wisconsin. We're actually one of the leaders in the country in terms of our uptake for small producers to be engaged in nutrient management planning. Great programs like the producer-led watershed grants just got expanded, and an additional money has been allocated to them in the state budget so that they can really do innovative projects to help reduce their runoff and improve runoff controls for things like phosphorus, nitrates, et cetera.
Do you think there's good uptake on that? Will farmers go after those types of grant efforts?
Well, we've been working really diligently, and we actually have a staff member here on staff at Wisconsin Farm Bureau who's focused on that exact thing, trying to improve sustainable farming practices. And I think that there's some really innovative things with the future of like alternative credit markets, carbon, and one in Wisconsin that I'm really proud of that we're just starting to get going, but I think has the potential to be a really great economic improvement for farmers, as well as a way for other people to comply with their permit requirements for wastewater, is we have a trading clearinghouse. So farmers can actually take on a land practice to improve their runoff outcomes and then sign that contract and have it paid for by, you know, somebody who has a WPDS permit or a wastewater permit to comply with their requirements, which the end result would be more of phosphorus coming out of waters because of the improvement of that that land practice. And that has to be done on a certain basis where more would be coming out than would be going in. But this is kind of in its infancy now. We're starting to get more and more farmers set up, and more, you know, water quality trades are happening. But I'm excited about the opportunity of expanding this so that third parties, just the way that you see carbon credits purchased now, could happen on water quality basis here in Wisconsin. And that would provide a secondary income to farmers, but also allow large corporations to purchase water quality offset credits so that they can look like they're improving their water quality as well. And I think everybody wins in those types of circumstances. So this is something we're paying very close attention to. And our farmers in Wisconsin, we have a much higher adoption rate of nutrient management plans. And I'm really focused on improving nutrient management plans within our non-point farms or smaller farms, just because I think that we have a great program in farmland preservation that incentivizes that. And we just got an uptake for that, an increase in those credits this past legislative cycle. So future adoption of those types of things, I really think will have an impact in the long run.
Jason Muniaini with us, Executive Director of Governmental Relations at the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation. Jason, just in a moment here, we only have about a minute left. Your group encouraging expanding the ability of DACA recipients to obtain job credentials from the state. What do you seek here?
So this is actually kind of an interesting one. I read this piece of legislation at first, and I kind of just put it out of sight, out of mind. I think it's great that the DACA recipients would be able to get professional credentials at what I think the original intent of the bill was at DSPS. But as I started to think more about it, there are professional credentials within agriculture that you have to go through DATCAP to get. So had a conversation with Secretary Romanski's office, and you know, they very quickly got back to me and said, yes, somebody who is a DACA recipient under this piece of legislation, which would authorize them to get credentials in food safety, you know, food labeling, inspections of meat facilities, those types of things. And that's really what in our food supply chain is that's one of the places where we're seeing kind of a backstop of the inspections, the safety requirements, those types of things that are kind of holding up food sometimes and resulting in a little bit of unnecessary food waste just because of the availability of those individuals. So for the people who are DACA recipients in Wisconsin, I think this is a great piece of legislation that Representative John Mocco has been working on to help, you know, alleviate some of the stress within the food supply chain and find individuals who would be able to serve in those roles. I think it's a great opportunity.
Jason, thank you for joining us.
Oh, always a pleasure. Love coming on here and chatting about anything agriculture. And if you're listening and you're a farmer, make sure you make it down to Ag Day in the Capitol on Wednesday at Monona Terrace.
Jason Muniaini is with the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, and you're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the United Methodist Church loses nearly a quarter of its total churches in recent years, according to a new report from the Lewis Center for Church Leadership, we examine the difficult decisions that Wisconsin congregations confront, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Reverend Brian Gilbert is Prairie Self-District Superintendent for the Northern Illinois Conference of the United Methodist Church. Reverend Gilbert, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You say three communities from your district have chosen to disaffiliate from the church. What is that process like? Can you walk us through it?
Yes. So, the first thing to understand in all of this is the United Methodist Church, unlike many other denominations, is what's called a connectional system, which means no church stands independently of their own. We all work together as a movement, and our basic building block for our denominational structure is something called an annual conference, which is a geographic area that meets once a year, why it's called an annual conference of clergy and laity that are the people that actually establish churches and send them out missionally, create new churches. And so once every 4 years, something called General Conference happens, which is where delegates from all over the world come together and create a rule book called the Book of Discipline. And in 2019, there was a paragraph added to the Book of Discipline called 2553. That's the paragraph number that allowed churches to disaffiliate or leave the denomination. Now, it set up a process that each annual conference was told to implement and could add to or create their own process in which churches could discern and vote to leave. So I'm in Northern Illinois Conference, so I'm just to the south of you all. And our process is a little different from how the churches in Wisconsin went through the process. But one of the things we did in this process is we wanted to make sure that as churches were considering if they wanted to leave or not, that we gave them as much information as we could and be as fair as we could in this process. And so when churches were inquiring about leaving, we met with them multiple times before they had a congregational vote to decide if they wanted to disaffiliate. And we discussed three different things. The first thing we talked with them about was their own congregational history, who they were as a church, where they came from, what their triumphs were, what their struggles were. The second thing we talked about was this is the denomination's history, theology, polity, just who we are as United Methodists. And the third thing was just the nuts and bolts of when you disaffiliate, there are certain, and you leave the denomination, there are certain things the denomination have been doing for the church legally. And talk through all the different things that a congregation has to do to incorporate, both within the state of Illinois, but also for the federal government to be a religious 501c3, because we didn't want churches to be unprepared for that, if that makes sense. Because there's a lot of legal things that need to happen that individual congregations, the United Methodist Church, hadn't had to do on their own before. And so if a church was in the process of leaving, we wanted them to have as full of a picture as possible so they weren't caught off guard and had the best chance to survive, because we don't want churches to falter.
To disintegrate or break apart further after a vote that can be, you know, certainly can split an individual congregation. And I'm wondering, Reverend Gilbert, you know, 2019, very much in the rearview mirror, but is the topic of exiting or disaffiliation now behind the United Methodist Church?
Well, if I could look in that crystal ball, I could write a book and retire tomorrow, probably. yes and no. I mean, it's a little bit of both. So the specific paragraph to 2553 had included on it a sunset clause. So when the legislation was written and passed in 2019, it had attached to it a timeline that said by the end of December 2023, this paragraph in the Book of Discipline will no longer be usable. So churches exiting underneath this book, this paragraph right now has stopped because we're in 2024 now. Now, the General Conference is going to be meeting in 2024, and they can change things. If the delegates that go wanted to change things, they could. There are also and have always been provisions in the Book of Discipline for if a congregation wanted to leave in a way that a congregation could exit the denomination does exist in the Book of Discipline. It's just not designed to be as expedited as 2553 was.
I just want to pause right here with Reverend Brian Gilbert, a district superintendent for the United Methodist Church's Northern Illinois Conference, as we talk about the historic schism. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org for questions and comments. Dan in Madison is here. Dan, go ahead.
Hi, Caden and Reverend Gilbert. I'm a member of a reconciling church, which means we're open. Our motto is all means all. And we want to bring open to all people of different sexual orientations. And we've been doing that for years. And I think it's one of the, there's sort of this secret, almost under the table recognition. I mean, I've been at churches where there's been gay clergy in the Methodist Church, but there's always been a minority faction that wants to keep with the Book of Discipline, which was written, my understanding, in the 60s and 70s, that says the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teachings. And I think the Methodists have been kind of slow. Lutherans, United Church of Christ, and other mainline Protestants have had this discussion painful and have moved on, and we're kind of just behind the curve.
And Dan, I want to stop you there and have Reverend Gilbert respond. Behind the curve, slow to respond. Go ahead, Reverend.
No one could ever say a church is not slow to respond to things, right? Churches, we'll fight over changing the color of the carpet, right, in our congregations. The United Methodist Church, he's absolutely right. In 1968, the United Methodist Church was formed. It was in 1972 that the restrictive language was added at the First General Conference of the United Methodist Church, which combined two different denominations at the time. And the United Methodist Church has been arguing and fighting with itself over this ever since. The reconciling movement was started to promote open and affirming churches that accept all LGBTQIA persons into clergy. And that has been gaining popularity among a lot of churches and a lot of conferences in Northern Illinois. Northern Illinois is what would be considered by me to be a reconciling conference. We have traditionalist churches that don't want to perform same-sex marriages, and we have congregations that are reconciling that do. And my hope is that at the end of the day, we can all sit around one large table and disagree, but still respect and love one another and affirm our common humanity and dignity, and work to end some of the things in the world that we disagree with, like child hunger or war or homelessness, to work together to end some of these things rather than expend our energy fighting with each other over matters of scriptural interpretation, that there is room for us to disagree and still respect one another and love one another.
Reverend Gilbert, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Reverend Brian Gilbert is Prairie South District Superintendent for the Northern Illinois Conference of the United Methodist Church. And this conversation continues. You can be part of it. Call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As thousands of United Methodist Church congregations choose to leave the denomination in recent years, including dozens here in Wisconsin, we examine the complex issues of disaffiliation and the shifts in the mainline Protestant denomination. And you can call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Stan Pegram is lead pastor of BMZ Church in Boscobel. Pastor Pegram, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Kate.
So last year in February, your congregation chooses to leave the United Methodist Church. Can you explain why?
Yes, I think it was, you know, it was probably years in the making and some difficulties. But as Brian mentioned, the 2019 General Conference seemed to be that tipping point because the reason, if I can just, I'll start with the reason that we left was more a breach of trust. As Brian said, you know, we have a large table that we sit at. We have many theological viewpoints, and I served on many conference committees and boards, and you know, we made that work. We worked hard at it, and it was difficult at times. There were times that we understood that we agreed to disagree at those tables, and we cared for each other. We respected each other for the most part, and so why disaffiliate? What was that tipping point? Well, for us, it was after the United Methodist Church is set up, in big picture, it's set up as a democracy where we have delegates. As Brian mentioned, we have a general conference every 4 years. We have delegates who represent the people in the pews all from all over the world. And they come together and make decisions and set policy. And here's the direction we're going to go, and here's how we're going to do things. Mm. And then after that, I think, there was a disagreement, at least with many on our Council of Bishops. So it's set up like a democracy, but we don't have a president. Mm-hmm. We have a Council of Bishops that helps guide us, and they agree. I mean, we're all in a covenant agreement with each other as how we're going to conduct ourselves. But after that, I know my bishop and then a number of other bishops, because they did not like how the vote went, in the 2019 Special General Conference, they invited, and I received, you know, communication that it would be okay to do civil disobedience and we could go against what we had all decided. Well, when we have that breach of trust and we've found out that we don't have checks and balances in place anymore and we can't govern ourselves and there's really not an accountability, and now each church can do whatever it wants, well, we're not much of a United Methodist Church anymore. And so that was kind of the tipping point for us to say, listen, if we can't govern ourselves, no, none of us really want to be part of an organization like that. So, you know, we had our theological conversations and et cetera, but it really boiled down to, it's hard to sit at that table and continue to have those conversations when we're not sure what the other person's going to do, we're not going to continue to do what we've agreed to do.
Yeah. What was the vote like in your congregation? How did that feel?
It was difficult for most of the people. I serve multiple smaller congregations. And most of them grew up in the United Methodist Church as I did. And so I think there was grieving. It was difficult. My dad was a pastor in the United Methodist Church from its inception back in the late 60s. I was a little kid. All I can remember is a cross in flame. And so to make those decisions was not easy, but it was worth having the conversation. I appreciate our conference. And it was challenging. We had a 17-step process to go through to disaffiliate, but we had to have the conversations. We had to talk about what we believe and why we believe it, and does this make sense for us? And but Kate, by the time it came to the vote, it was almost unanimous in each one of our. So I have six congregations that I serve. Mm-hmm. At that time, I had six, and so each one of those churches had to make their own decision in how they would move forward. So I'm part of that conversation and. But each one of them was unanimous. Our larger church, with 70 plus voters, we had a couple that said, you know, we'd rather not disaffiliate, but it was almost unanimous.
There is the movement among disaffiliated communities to join the Global Methodist Church. Your church is one that joined. Why join another organization after leaving the United Methodist Church?
for me as their pastor, I'm still Methodist at heart. And connectionalism, as Brian mentioned earlier, matters. I think we are better together when we can partner with other churches and continue to reach into different communities. I just think that's important. Like I said, I grew up in the Methodist world, and it felt like that's what, you know, the Global Methodist Church was putting into place, what I kind of thought I agreed to when I became part of the United Methodist Church and was ordained in the United Methodist Church. And so it's a fledgling organization. You know, we're only about 18, 20 months old. And there's been a lot of work to try to build that as we go forward, but it feels like there's more alignment, if that makes sense. And I'm praying that in the United Methodist Church, there's more alignment and we're not as divided, and they can continue to be the church that God's calling them to be, and feel like we're in a place in the Global Methodist Church that we can be the church that God's calling us to be.
Stan Pegram, lead pastor of BMZ Church in Boscobel, as we talk about dozens of Wisconsin churches leaving the United Methodist Church. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Pastor Pegram, in order to leave, it required communities to meet certain financial obligations, like covering all the debts and pensions. How challenging has that been to meet those financial obligations?
It was incredibly challenging. You know, we kind of knew something was coming. And so when we could, we would set aside finances and create accounts where we could be prepared as we could, because we knew a split was coming at some point or something was going to happen. We just didn't know what it was going to look like. But to come out of that trust clause with the United Methodist Church, and as you know, there were challenges, and like I said, I appreciate the conference making sure. I'll go back to Brian, because he said, you know, we had to put certain things in place so that legally it could happen and they would be covered, and so all that was put in place in Wisconsin as well. The cost for many churches in our conference, I believe, was prohibitive. I think some were wanting to disaffiliate but could not afford it. It was difficult for us. It's difficult to convince congregants, even though they've been in the Methodist Church all their lives, that we have to pay to have the buildings that we've already paid for. We have to pay to have the finances that we've already contributed to. And those are challenging conversations, but we were able to work our way through it. And like I said, a lot of conversations, a lot of work to be done to get there. But felt like it was worth it for us.
The United Methodist Church reconvening for its first conference since 2019, happening later this spring. Would your church consider returning, depending on what happens at the conference?
I don't think so. I think we are in a place where the Global Methodist Church feels like it's moving in a good direction. We're invested there now.
In what way?
Well, we are now paying in apportionments. I serve as leader in our conference, one of the leaders in our conference. We're trying to care for other churches around us that are Global Methodist. And we're trying, you know, putting together ministries that we can do together. Like I said, it's a fledgling organization. We're young, and we're kind of putting it together as we go. Something about, you know, building the plane as you fly it. So I think, you know, our time and our energy and things are headed in that direction. And how do we help this? How do we as local congregations help a new conference and a new denomination move forward?
Pastor Pegram, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Stan Pegram is lead pastor of BMZ Church in Boscobel. And there's room to talk about faith communities and tensions in belief systems. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. United Methodist churches have had an opening to leave the denomination over disputes involving same-sex marriage and gay clergy. More than 40 congregations have disaffiliated in Wisconsin, according to a new report from the Lewis Center for Church Leadership. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can add your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Wiegand is lead pastor at First United Methodist Church in Madison. Reverend Wiegand, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
And Krista Deedy is here, lead pastor of Onalaska United Methodist Church. Reverend Deedy, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Reverend Deedy, let's start with you. As we see roughly a quarter of Methodist churches choosing to leave, according to this new report, and Wisconsin Conference approving 43 disaffiliations. What effect is this process having on the Wisconsin Methodist community?
It was a very trying experience to watch congregations and clergy who had had relationships over many years say goodbye to one another, especially when many of the congregation members were not fully on board with the decision to disaffiliate. It was interesting to see that 43% of the membership for those that disaffiliated made the decision for the other 53%.
I wonder, Reverend Wiegand, what thoughts come up to you as you watch this process?
I think for me, the process was extensive in such a way, it was done with such care and consideration, but it took so much time and energy and resources. And that's hard because the church has so much work to do in being in the world and loving people and offering grace and hospitality in meaningful ways. And to pause to do the work of disaffiliation really made a difference for a time in how the local churches I served in anyway could engage ministry.
How much consensus is there among your members to stay? What have you heard?
I've served in two churches through this process. I was serving in Oshkosh and moved to Madison this summer. Both congregations are reconciling congregations and have had meaningful conversations for years about what it means to be open and affirming and to celebrate queer people in the life of the church, to include them in every possible way. So for those congregations, conversations happened in good and healthy ways, but because of the history of that, those churches, there was never really a question about what direction they would go. They want change in the United Methodist Church. They want the laws that discriminate that are in the Book of Discipline to come out. And our hope is that in the 2024 General Conference, that will finally happen in a meaningful way and can shift fully how we live together as congregations that are part of the United Methodist Church.
Reverend Deedy, how has this global process of disaffiliation affected membership at churches?
I would say that I've served two congregations, one that was a very more conservative, and when the topic of inclusion of queer people was presented after our 2019 General Conference, it was very apparent that the congregation was against inclusion. And so that was a very painful process to experience with them. And then I recently was moved to the Onalaska Church, where they too are a reconciling congregation. And so that has been a blessing to see the difference between the two. I would say that despite the position as a reconciling congregation versus a non-reconciling congregation, that those people who were in the camp of agree to disagree are still deciding whether or not that they can stay in a congregation that becomes fully reconciling.
Oh, so there still is those tensions. I also wonder, you know, the Global Methodist Church has added thousands of congregations in this process. How is it a departure from the United Methodist Church?
They have a very particular understanding of reading scripture in a much more literal interpretation. They claim to be a completely fresh and new expression of Methodism. However, when you look at their Book of Discipline, which is it's the similar type to what our Book of Discipline is, and the way they practice, essentially they just changed a few things and are essentially operating very similarly to United Methodists. So other than the literal interpretation of scripture, they're operating very similarly to the United Methodist Church.
Krista Deedy is lead pastor at Unalaska United Methodist Church. Kathy Wiegand with us, lead pastor at First United Methodist Church in Madison, as we talk about this historic split in the church. And you can join in. Questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Wendy in Oconomowoc is here. Hi, Wendy. Go ahead.
Hi. In 2019, our church in Oconomowoc, we had meetings. We went through this. We educated the congregation as to what the upcoming changes were, and we unanimously decided to stay with the United Methodist Church. Your previous guest, who seemed to be skirting around the issue, talking about like individual rights, kind of reminds me of the Civil War, where they didn't want to talk about slavery. They talked about states' rights. Very similar. And we in the United Methodist Church actually had a division at that time, too, and healed from it. So I really think that a lot of these churches are using that as an excuse. The global church, my understanding, and the pastor probably from Madison probably knows more about this than me, but that the global church is more discriminating against LGBTQ people than the American church.
Wendy, thank you. I want Reverend Wiegand to respond. Go ahead.
I think it's interesting that she raised the Civil War and issue of slavery, because the church split North and South during that time, and it took 95 years to come back together. So interestingly, or sadly, the United Methodist Church has a history going back to our very beginnings about church split over ideologies and theologies and practices. So at some point, this isn't new to us, although it is new to how we live currently in the system. I don't know how we think ahead other than to say we're deeply committed to loving God and loving all of our neighbors and offering grace and hope wherever and however we can, and to do that work as congregations together in our communities with the hope of having impact for people who have been marginalized and oppressed and left out and discriminated against. It is our hope as the United Methodist Church that we can focus our time and our energy on those things.
Reverend Wiegand, why can't there be differences between congregations surrounding LGBTQ plus inclusion?
The beauty of the United Methodist Church is that one of the things we use is called the Wesleyan Quadrilateral, where we say scripture is our primary source. But when we're thinking about our life and how we feel about things and how we frame our faith, we also add into it tradition and reason and experience, which means there isn't a lot of black and white. We wrestle with our faith as individuals and as congregations. So how we engage it can be different without question. I think for this particular instance, since the Book of Discipline says currently that queer clergy, queer people cannot be ordained in the United Methodist Church, that it is not legal for us to do same gender wedding ceremonies. And many of us were choosing to break the rules and live in defiance of those rules for reasons we felt were incredibly important. As you heard Stan say earlier, there was a difference in how we wanted the legislation of that and in the judicial part of that to play out.
Reverend Deedy, on Alaska, what's next for your communities as part of the United Methodist Church, and as you look ahead?
For us, we continue to preach the good news, to invite people to know that they are beloved, that there is a place for them in the church, and that there can be healing for circumstances that, you know, not long ago, they were feeling rejected by the church because they weren't sure whether the church would accept them for who they are. And so there's a lot of reconciliation happening with people who are realizing that we really are inclusive and supportive and excited for the gifts and graces that they bring to our congregational life, and that their thoughts about how to reach people for Jesus Christ is so important. So that making space for people to really be themselves is what Unalaska is focusing on right now.
Reverend Krista Deedy and Reverend Kathy Wiegand, they lead United Methodist congregations in Unalaska and Madison, respectively. Call in with a question. You can share your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the United Methodist Church divides along lines of progressive and traditional theological values, we hear from two Wisconsin pastors on the complexities of disaffiliation and finding home in a faith community. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective, 800-642-1234. We have Reverend Kathy Wiegand, who leads First United Methodist Church in Madison, and Reverend Krista Deedy, who leads Unalaska United Methodist Church. Reverend Deedy, you're one of the clergy who will be representing Wisconsin in the upcoming General Conference in the spring. What are your priorities for the international meeting?
Interestingly, the focus will be on the regionalization of practice so that churches that are across the globe can contextualize their ministry and do and care for people in a way that makes sense to that particular context. We have been working diligently to solidify our social principles. Right now, we have a very large volume that shares all of the things that we value and hold deeply in our faith tradition, and they are making them more concise, so that there isn't confusion when it is practiced across the globe. And then finally, the other priority is to remove the harmful language in the Book of Discipline, which is contradictory in terms of saying that every person is of great value. However, if you are an LGBTQ person, somehow you are not necessarily valued in the same way. And so the hope is to accomplish all three of those very large and complicated issues as we move into our general conference.
Reverend Wiegand, as you watch the general conference and that last piece there of what Reverend Deedy said, the harmful language, do you think that the conference can come to some type of agreement, some type of level understanding?
Well, I think the votes will shift in some ways, so there is some hope for movement. The other piece is simply that, and Krista alluded to this too, the church has caused such significant and often irreparable harm to the queer community. You know, we know those stories from the media. We've heard those stories from our queer siblings. So my hope is that the general church can do that hard work of moving forward and extending radical welcome and full inclusion in every aspect of the church in all of the ways that we can, so that some healing from some of that trauma can begin to happen, because it's been decades.
The Board of Wisconsin's United Methodist Conference says sexual orientation and gender identity are insufficient reasons to deny someone's call to ministry. What makes someone a quality pastor?
Krista and I both serve on the Board of Ordained Ministry, who worked very hard and for days to draft that statement, to let people know that sexual orientation and gender identity were not reasons in and of themselves to say no to someone who wanted to come into ministry. If we're looking for what makes a healthy pastor, we're looking for someone who's well-educated, who can speak theology in a way that speaks to people and the realities of their lives. We're looking for someone who is spiritually growing, someone who is mentally healthy, someone who can lead well. We go through a big process in the United Methodist Church to ordain people. And there are so many facets of what it takes to be ordained. For us who have witnessed queer clergy doing amazing work, it is heartbreaking to see how many people have left ministry or never came into ministry because they were unwilling to live with that kind of discrimination or to live a closeted life. Mm-hmm. And if we can remove some of those barriers and let God work through people who are gifted and called, that is our hope.
Let's bring on Mark in Wauwatosa. Mark, what would you like to share?
Hi. Yeah, I was a member of a UMC. I left my family. We left this year. I don't know, we might come back. It was a reconciling congregation. We were longtime members. Just a personal struggle. You know, didn't like the way the vote went a few years back to become reconciling. I always felt that the term radical hospitality was, I don't know, a bit radical. And last week, the pastor spoke of heterosexualism while talking about isms as schisms, I don't know, that sounded kind of radical. But I think it's been a strategic blunder that has cost the church greatly. More people have avoided coming or avoided joining than, and some have left. And I don't know, that's just my personal struggle with that. That's all.
Mark, thank you for calling in. Reverend Didi in Onalaska, what comes up for you?
I'm hearing Mark share his witnesses, something that many congregations have wrestled with. Because we, as United Methodists, consider ourselves to be a wide tent for different theologies and understandings of how Scripture informs us personally and collectively, I can appreciate, because I've heard from my own congregation members who are among those who are, you know, voted no when the reconciliation process was completed, that they've decided to stay, but that sometimes they feel as if some of the ways that we try to create hospitality for people kind of offends them in some ways. For an example, when I introduce myself, I will use my pronouns as a way for people to know that it is important and an act of hospitality for especially transgender people to know that they are really welcome, and that we celebrate and make space for things that will be those cues to them, that we're not just a sign on the door. When they walk in, they will experience something different than what they have before. And so I can appreciate Mark's struggle with hearing things that seem radical to his theology and his experience. And all I would invite people who are who are going through a similar thing to do is sometimes I believe that's God inviting us to dig into why that is bothersome mm-hmm. for us, and to gain a greater understanding of what is it that's triggering this, and what can I learn, or what can I use the quadrilateral, as Kathy outlined, to help me to understand why I'm having this response.
And Reverend Wiegand, in our final moments together, does the conflict have you revisiting any Christian stories or teachings?
I think for me, maybe the most important one from the Gospel of Luke, there was an expert in religious law who asked Jesus what he was supposed to be doing in life. And it came around to the idea that our job is to love God and to love our neighbors. And so the lawyer said, "Who's my neighbor?" And so the reflection on who's my neighbor was the story told about the Good Samaritan, which brought in someone who was very different, someone who was unexpectedly the hero of the story. I think it reminds us that our neighbors are people we might not expect. And we have to be looking for God's presence in each and every person we meet. And if we can do that well, we begin to make a difference as the Holy Spirit engages people in new and loving and grace-filled ways.
Reverend Wiegand and Reverend Didi, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That is Reverend Krista Didi of Onalaska United Methodist Church and Reverend Kathy Wiegand of First United Methodist Church in Madison. And earlier, we spoke with Pastor Stan Pegram of BMZ Church in Boscobel and Reverend Brian Gilbert of the Northern Illinois Conference of the United Methodist Church. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.